If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's hard not to add a side of hot, crispy hash browns to your favorite McDonald's breakfast. It's even harder not to eat said hash browns before you get home. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
He goes to the morgue and he finds the corpse of Aidarov and sees that it's moving and that he's still breathing and that its fingers are twitching. So this guy was literally brought back from the dead, from the morgue, and brought back to life by extra rations. He becomes the player of the most physically, and in a way, emotionally demanding part in the whole symphony.
That was Tom Service talking about the Leningrad Symphony.
You really are scraping the barrel in terms of the kind of stuff they were throwing in their bread. I mean, awful. And the taste of that stuff was just remarkable. For me, that was the taste of poverty. If you could actually eat that bread, you must have been starving.
And that was Alex Langlands on Victorian baking. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our fifth podcast of December 2015, and indeed our final episode of the year. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. I hope you've all had an enjoyable Christmas. We begin this episode with an interview with Tom Service, a music writer and presenter on BBC Radio 3. This Saturday, Tom will co-present a documentary on BBC Two with historian Amanda Vickery, about Dmitri Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony. This remarkable piece of music was written by the Soviet composer during the Nazi siege of Leningrad, and incredibly, a performance of the symphony took place in the ravaged city in August 1942. I caught up with Tom a couple of weeks ago and began by asking what first drew him to this story.
It's an easier question to ask what doesn't draw you to it. I don't mean that it's the sense of tragedy and everything else that draws you to the story, but musically speaking, above all, the concert that's given on the 9th of August 1942 in the Grand Hall of the Philharmonia in St. Petersburg of the Leningrad Symphony. It's just one of the most astonishing performances ever to have happened, I think, in the history of 20th century music, quite honestly, possibly in all of musical history. Not just because of the human stories that it reveals about the conductor, Carl Eddie Asperg, and the 80 musicians who were all kind of rescued in one way or another from the torment of the siege in order to put that performance on, but also because of the very, really almost unique situation and status of the piece that Shostakovich wrote, that he starts writing it actually, you know, as the bombs are falling. The first time that anybody hears the music, he plays the first two movements of it to friends, and he has to take his family down to the air raid shelter after the first movement, you know, brings them back in order to continue on with the performance. The idea of achieving this absolutely gigantic and astonishingly ambitious musical structure that has something very clear, very pertinent, and very moving to say about the circumstances in which it was written, but is also, you know, one of the grandest symphonies of the 20th century. That as well, you know, that combination of that performance, absolutely this sort of siege transcending heroism of everyone who's in the hall, not just by the way on stage, but also everyone who's there in the audience as well, and also Shostakovich's achievement. It makes it simply, you know, just a story that required to be told, if you like. And I hope, you know, if we can do any fragment of this story justice in what we've done, then I hope it'll be moving and involving for people to see.
What kind of a man was Shostakovich? For listeners who may not know much about him, how would you describe him?
He was a prodigious musical talent, obviously, that's clear. As a teenager, he'd already written, he wrote the most extraordinary symphony ever written by a teenager, his first, which is still one of the most virtuosically, brilliantly dazzling, imaginative, life-enhancing pieces of music of the 20th century. As a person, there are in a way many different Shostakoviches. What I mean by that is that growing up, he seemed to be an extremely extrovert character. He loved football. He was very funny. He would play the piano at the silent movie theatres. This was a character who, absolutely someone who really loved life. There are early photographs of him smiling through sort of, you know, bottle top thick glasses, which he always wore. But, you know, this is a guy who's smiling, who's having a lot of fun. And a lot of that early music is full of a real, well, I use revolutionary with a small r, if you like, a kind of sense of parody and satire often, and fun, as well as tapping into all the bigger things that he wanted to do as a composer. All of that changes, however, in terms of his character, because of his relationship with the Soviets and what happens, especially in his relationship with Joseph Stalin, because he becomes very quickly a famous composer, but his music is censured at exactly the moment it's becoming most successful. And the most famous article that reveals that is something that started, we talk about this in the film, and in fact I've seen the article in Pravda, you know, the organ of Soviet Russia, Truth in Russian, an article that's called Muddle Instead of Music, which was said to be written by Stalin himself, which denounces his extraordinary opera, which had been very successful, called Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensk district. And from that moment on, Shostakovich's relationship with the regime changed completely, because he felt that he could basically no longer trust anyone in power. Of course, then he experiences what happens in the purges of the 1930s, and almost himself, shortly after this denouncement in 1936, the following year, 1937, he's almost carted off to the Gulag himself, or worse. The only thing that saves him is that the officer, or the, you know, the KGB guy who asked him to come back, had been shot from one day to the next. That's the only reason that Shostakovich survived. So from that point on, he's a man knowing that he's treading the extraordinarily thin ice that the major cultural figures of Soviet Russia had to do. His personality changes at that point. And if you see, there is film of him later in his life in the 1950s, 60s and 70s. You know, this is a man who wears the scars in his personality of how impossible it is to speak the truth in public. You know, you can read that very clearly. So he's the personality changes deeply. The thing that remains constant, though, is the power, creativity and courage of the music.
What inspired him to write this symphony about Leningrad at this time?
Because of the siege. I mean, you know, the Germans arrive in June 1941. Stalin thinks that the pact will hold, and he's unbelievably naive. He thinks that the Nazis are gonna keep to their word. And of course, they don't. So almost as soon as the siege starts, Shostakovich begins to I mean, it's wrong to say that he translates directly the experience of the bombs falling. You don't hear bombs falling in the symphony. What you do hear is an invasion. And in the huge first movement, this is a virtually unprecedented thing. It is an unprecedented thing. It lasts about half an hour or 25 minutes. And in the middle of it, there's this little gnarl tune which starts. There's a side drum. It's very quiet. And it takes over the orchestra, and it virtually sort of blows apart the whole first movement of the symphony. Now, that was called the invasion theme, because it sounds like, you know, something in the distance, something that you see, you know, that doesn't seem to be doing much, which then eventually destroys something. So it's clearly a musical image of invasion. Now, that absolutely is about what's happening around him. So it's an unbelievably direct response. I mean, it has other meanings too, but it's partly an extremely direct response to what's happening, to this city being starved, strangled, and sieged to death. That's what the Nazis wanted to do to Leningrad.
Could you give us an idea of exactly what it was like to live through the siege of Leningrad?
The most powerful testimony about that in the film, and the thing that struck me the keenest, and I think will strike anyone who sees the film, is the testimony from two 90-year-olds who were at the performance of the symphony in 1942. Now, look, there are two stories of what they went through in the siege, and especially Olga's. Clearly, they're a tiny fragment of what the whole city went through in the more than 1 million, I can't remember, you need to check out the exact figure of how many people died in the siege, but it's, you know, it is hundreds of thousands of lives that were lost, of course. Olga's story tells, I think, so keenly about the hardship that they went through. There's one astonishing moment where she's working at an orphanage, and in that first winter of 1941-42, which is one of the coldest on record, she goes to the top of the orphanage. It's all unheated, and there's a Christmas tree, and she thinks there are presents under the tree. And they aren't packages, they're dead children, because they've been, the corpses have been moved up there to this room, and she can't, you know, she can't forget that image. But I mean, that's one fragment of how appalling life was. Really, it's the stories that Amanda Vickery tells in the film about how the rations were appallingly meagre. You had 125 grams of bread a day to live on, but actually this was a adulterated flour that was from, you know, sawdust and anything else they could find on the floor. And the people were making soup out of boiled shoe leather. And we get a real sense in the film of the privations that the city went through for so many months and years, because of course it wasn't formally lifted the siege until early 1944.
Once Shostakovich had completed the symphony, how popular was it initially? Did it really strike a chord with Russia?
The symphony was premiered in Koibyshev, which was the city to which Shostakovich and the Soviet government had been evacuated. Shostakovich was evacuated from the siege in October 1941, and he finished the symphony in Koibyshev with his family. It was quickly premiered in Moscow, and at the Moscow performance, somebody said in the audience or commented that Shostakovich was now more powerful than Hitler. What that meant was the Russians absolutely heard in it a sense of defiance. And frankly, I mean, in a sense, a kind of rather more obvious thing, which is, here is this huge 80-minute long symphony, which has been written in, you know, one of the most appalling periods of the history of the Second World War. So despite everything that the Germans were doing, this was a culture that was still capable of producing the Leningrad Symphony. You know, that in itself is an extraordinary symbol. It became extremely popular, not just in Russia, but all over the world very quickly. There was a flight that was commandeered. The symphony was taken out of Russia, where it flew, the plane went via Tehran. It escaped the German anti-aircraft fire and got to Tehran, Cairo, and then ended up in London. And it was Henry Wood played it, and it was broadcast on the BBC. There was great consternation at the BBC whether the symphony would overrun the 9 o'clock bongs of Big Ben. But it was heard as an incredibly powerful symbol of Allied resistance. I mean, of the whole of the anti-Nazi world used the symphony wanted to use the symphony as a symbol of resistance, and the fact that, you know, culture would survive, and the fact that this culture could be a symbol of an eventual victory over the Germans. The piece itself is in a way a narrative of tragedy, invasion, the unbelievably dark but also sort of brilliant, luminous, it's a strange contradiction, but the slow movement of the symphony is simultaneously a lament, and yet it's something full of, I don't know, there's a brightness and sharpness in those colours as well. But anyway, the symphony does end with an image of victory. Later in 1942, or rather in July 1942, Arturo Toscanini conducted it with the NBC Symphony Orchestra, and it was broadcast to millions in America. And that same week, Shostakovich himself was on the cover of Time, dressed in the the firefighter's uniform, because he'd been employed as a firefighter on the roof of the Leningrad Conservatory where he trained. So there was this moment where, you know, Red Russia, previously not exactly a friend of the Americans, now the whole world was joined against the Germans, and the symphony was audible proof, well, of hope, of defiance, and of possibility. And it had more than 100 performances very, very quickly. So yeah, it was taken on by the whole world, not just Russia, as a powerful symbol of a hope for victory.
As well as its huge political and historical importance, did people at the time recognise it for the musical quality of it too?
Yes, although that was controversial. Interestingly, I mean, there are many testimonies of how powerfully it's gone down and how powerfully it's resonated with people. But there was also criticism about the American critic called Virgil Thompson heard as the crudity of the way it had been put together. And he said, you know, if he goes on writing like this, he'll no longer be able to be taken seriously as a serious composer. There were a few dissenting voices, and in a way that criticism of the symphony in a way continues to today. Actually, there are some people who hear it a sort of poster paint crudity as opposed to a work of symphonic sophistication. For me, it definitely is, but it is in quite a strange way, in a way that was brought home to me by Marina Frolova-Walker, who appears in the film as well, Russian musicologist at the University of Cambridge. But we played the piano together. I'm an appalling pianist, she's much better than me, but anyway, we tried to hack through part of the symphony. Something like this. I mean, one of the things about this invasion theme that I've been, this very simple theme, ba dee ba bum bum, dee ba ba bum bum, dee ba ba bum bum, ba da da dee da 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 ba da da da, on and on and on and on, over and over and over and over and over again. People said at the time, well, it's just Nick from Ravel's Bolero, or, you know, why this endless repetition of this stupid little theme? And as Marina told me, the stupidness, if you like, is precisely the point, because what the whole thing symbolizes is the idea that something so mundane, so banal, so simple can become so evil, can become an agent and a harbinger of such destruction and sort of ideological and physical and everything, warfare. And as she says in the film, I think it makes a very good point that, you know, what are Stalin and Hitler but a mediocre poet and a mediocre painter, and, you know, look what happened. So what some people hear is the, if you like, the quote-unquote crudity of the composition, for me, is actually proof precisely of its sophistication, because in order to be able to make that meaning work, you have to be incredibly sophisticated as a composer to do that job. And there's no doubt the symphony, that part of it and the whole piece, achieves that objective. Maxim Shostakovich, the composer's son, and in making the film, we were lucky enough that he was conducting the orchestra in the same hall where it was played in Leningrad, St. Petersburg. I mean, he remembers he was three when he heard the premiere in 1942 in Korbyshev with his family. And he remembers being simply terrified by this tune, this innocent little collection of notes, which nonetheless assumes this absolutely horrific, overwhelming, violent power. And, you know, he had nightmares about it. So this is a deeply ambitious and still relevant, still meaningful symphony, I think.
You did allude to it earlier, but there's this moment where, there's an incredible moment you talk about in the film, where they perform the symphony for the first time in Leningrad, a city still under siege and with people still, you know, starving to death. How much of a challenge was it to make that happen?
Well, it is actually unbelievable when you hear the stories about how it happened. The orchestra had been completely decimated, emaciated, those aren't the words, destroyed by that winter. This was an orchestra of 80, 90 people. By the time that the authorities said, look, we've got to get some music back, that was because, by the way, all that the radio had been broadcasting through the winter was the sound of a ticking metronome as proof that the city was still alive. Of course, that ends up sounding like a beetle in his death throes, like a death rattle rather than proof of life. So they said, look, spring 1942, we've got to get the orchestra back together to give people hope, to make people feel that the city's cultural life still goes on. And what Carl Eliasberg, who was the only surviving conductor, there were 27 musicians who were still alive, and there were 12 who could still actually play. So, I mean, that was never going to be enough to play, you know, a Beethoven symphony, let alone this piece. There's a again, the experience in this in the film, where I tell this story in the film, but the call goes out to ask musicians to report to the radio house, the Radio Dom, and, you know, a lot of people turn up because anybody who does and anybody who's accepted in the orchestra is going to get extra rations. Well, of course, that, you know, there's no more powerful thing that you can offer a starving population, of course, some of whom would even turn to cannibalism. You know, that was the desperation that the city was reduced to. So obviously the idea of extra rations was going to get people through the doors. Some of them who turned up could hardly play anything or even had no musical ability at all, perhaps not surprisingly. And so Eliasberg realised that he didn't have nearly enough musicians. He goes out on his bike through the slushy snow and he hears about this drummer called Zhaudar Aidarov. He hears that he's dead. I mean, he goes to check. I mean, it's kind of a strange thing to do, I guess. Why would you check that somebody was dead? Anyway, he goes to the morgue and sees that this he finds the corpse of Aidarov and sees that it's moving and that he's still breathing and that his fingers are twitching. So this guy was literally brought back from the dead, from the morgue, and brought back to life by extra rations. He becomes the player of the most physically and in a way emotionally demanding part in the whole symphony, which is the side drum that incessantly beats that invasion in the first movement and has a big important part to play throughout the symphony. I mean, you know, a story like that just symbolizes how difficult it was to put it together. And just one more thing on that. One of those things where it now seems sort of inevitable that this performance happened because, of course, the symphony had to come back to Leningrad and, of course, it had to be done. Well, not only was that, of course, in doubt for all of the reasons of, you know, starvation and everything else, when Eliasberg saw the score, and I've seen in the film the score that he conducted from, the one that was flown over from Koibyshev, and you know it's in four volumes. Well, that in itself tells a story because each movement requires its own book. Effectively, I mean that showed the scale of it. So he opened it and could see there had been 115 musicians playing at the premiere. He knew he was never going to get near that number. It's a piece that lasts about 80 minutes, between 70 and 80 minutes. It's got unbelievable sort of fortissimo blaring things for the brass and the wind, huge sort of labor for the strings as well. Let alone what's going on in the percussion section. I mean, he just thought it was impossible. I mean, and you know, in a way, it really is and was impossible. I mean, the fact that performance happened and then they repeated it genuinely is. It's sort of, again, miracle is really not too strong a word for that collective will, that sheer strength and determination to make that happen, to make those performances happen. I mean, it is unbelievable. And I hope in the film we communicate that sense of just how just extraordinary that this happened at all, you know.
And in the film, you talk to some people who actually were there at that performance. And how do they recollect it nowadays?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, in a way that, you know, the moment that, where sort of you feel watching her that kind of time collapses, you know, you're with her. Olga, who was, I think she was 18 when she saw the performance in 1942. And she tells the cameras, tells us, but it is the way she talks. It's really like she's talking to you individually. It's absolutely amazing about the effect this had on her, how she reads her own tragedy through it. You know, her father and grandfather had died. She has this experience of seeing these dead children under a Christmas tree. I mean, all these sorts of things. But she, you know, she dresses up. She wants to go to the Grand Hall of Philharmonia to a concert. If that, oh, that's a real thing about thinking, well, the city can come back to life. We can do this. And then the piece happens. And the way she talks about the effect that the music had, again, all these things that as historians, you want to try and say, well, the piece symbolized this, or it tells the story of the siege and it works up into victory. Look, for her, that's absolutely what it was. You know, she heard her tragedy transcended in the music, and at the end of it, she hears a proof and a kind of the most gigantic, you know, two fingers, whatever, to the Germans that this is, you know, you are not going to win. You cannot beat us. You cannot beat a city that can make this happen. We have done this, and you've got nothing on it. The fact that we can do that means that we're going to win in the end. And not only is that real for her, that was real for, I'm sure, for everybody in that audience, and for everybody who heard the performance too, not least, by the way, the Germans. And I think there's a particularly brilliant thing that, because the performance was broadcast to the German lines. Now the Soviet barrage had stopped, or they'd done their bombing earlier in the day to sort of try and quiet the German guns, or any guns ideally, during the performance. And of course, you know, it's a long piece, that's an important thing to do. But then broadcasting to the Germans for whom the definition of their culture is music. You know, their culture is a musical culture. So when the German soldiers, and we know this happened from testimony, again, the Germans who were there, they felt utterly demoralized at the scale, scope, and intensity of what they were hearing. From a German perspective, hearing music as proof of life, they understood better than anyone what that meant. So, you know, the symphony did have an absolutely direct propaganda and demoralizing effect on the enemy, on the besiegers, just as it had this tremendously, the power that Olga expresses in the film about what it meant to her.
And what do you think more broadly about what this says about the power of music and art more generally to to kind of lift people in really difficult times.
There's no more powerful symbol of how a communal act of music making or any artistic or cultural experience can not just lift spirits, but can become part of the way that in the most desperate times it's possible to imagine, can become a sounding board in which people can come together and hear themselves reflected and transcended in it. This symphony, these performances in Leningrad certainly, but actually in a sense all around the world at this time as well, prove that better, I think, than any other single, you know, cultural document of the 20th century.
Finally, the documentary, you spent quite a lot of time in St. Petersburg, as Leningrad is called now. Mm. How do people there view the symphony, you know, in the 21st century?
The Leningrad Symphony today is an essential document of history, of course. And making the film, watching the film, you understand this is a piece that belongs to Olga and Tamara, who were there in 1942, belongs to Dmitri Shostakovich's son, Maxim, who's conducting the orchestra in our film, and it belongs to that city. When you hear that the players in the orchestra, who, by the way, are the sort of direct musical descendants of the Radiocom orchestra that played it on the 9th of August 1942, you know, they feel it as their music, and they understand, and it truly is. And the way that the performance is commemorated outside the hall, it's something that the Russians or anyone who goes to that hall is made aware of every time. This piece, this performance, this city, absolutely symbiotically connected still today, absolutely. But I think in making it, the power of the story and the power of the music, of course, is that it goes beyond all those things as well. I think it speaks for today. It's a piece that has a cathartic power for any situation where you need to confront the honesty of the darkness and the desperation of whatever has been happening in your life or a culture's life or a nation's life or whatever. But to hear the hope, not for a kind of victory which wipes out what's gone beyond before, which acknowledges the pain of what you've been through and also offers the possibility of a new life at the end of it. I mean, in a way, the reason that the symphony still matters today in Leningrad and across the world is, of course, it's about these circumstances which gave rise to it, but it is also because of this astonishing thing that music can do, that it can realize all that experience all the time. So that meaning, that drama, that essential power, trajectory of the music remains as, you know, as relevantly resonant to, you know, frankly, to all of us today as it did then. Through the telling of those stories of Olga and Tamara, for me, it makes, in a strange way, it makes that potentially universal or global power of the music, brings it home to me even more powerfully.
That was Tom Service. Leningrad and the Orchestra That Defied Hitler, presented by Tom and Amanda Vickery, is due to air this Saturday, the 2nd of January, at 9:10 p.m. on BBC Two. And it should be available on BBC iPlayer after that. And I should also mention that you can read an article from Tom about the Leningrad Symphony in the January issue of our sister title, BBC Music Magazine. You can find out more at classical-music.com. In the meantime, our Christmas edition is still on sale for just a couple more days. In this month's issue, we have articles on Victorian poverty, Elizabeth I's rivalry with Mary, Queen of Scots, the medieval history behind Game of Thrones, and the Battle of the Atlantic, among other things. You can get hold of our Christmas edition in all good newsagents and our many digital formats.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Our second interview this week is with Alex Langlands, a historian and broadcaster. He is co-presenter of a new BBC Two series entitled Victorian Bakers, which sees a group of modern bakers experience the conditions of their 19th century predecessors. At the same time, the series will explore what bread production tells us about Victorian social and economic changes. I spoke to Alex recently to find out more. How different was the Victorian baking world from what we experience today, what we know today?
It kind of depends on what period. I mean, the great thing about this show is that we tested our bakers in three different periods of Victoria's reign, because, you know, as we know, it's a very long reign, almost as long as our own Queen's reign. And we start our bakers off in the sort of 1830s. They then move into the mid-Victorian nadir, as I like to call it, the sort of low point, if you like, before coming out the other end of that into a kind of more Edwardian and 20th century looking form of baking. So, you know, that last program in the series, I think they were very much more in their comfort zones in terms of being familiar with that world of baking. But what was, I think, most fun for me as a historian who often deals with very early periods of history was to see them battling with that very early period, because really baking in the 1830s was remarkably different to how it's become today.
Is that largely a matter of technology?
Largely technology, yes. I mean, largely technology, but also audiences, markets, who you're actually baking for. I mean, you know, those early bakeries, we were set in this wonderful location, Sacrewell, up in Cambridgeshire. And there they have an authentic late 18th, early 19th century bakehouse. Very, very basic, incredibly basic, really. So there's a lack of technology there. But the other thing is that you're baking for really your local community. So the options for thinking commercially are very limited, actually. It's, in some ways, it's almost more of a public service than it is a kind of business that you can take and develop and grow. So you had to think quite differently. So that was a challenge for some of our bakers, but definitely the technology. I mean, I think a lot of them found it very hard going back to such raw ingredients, because we also did our level best to attempt to source period varieties of wheat and period varieties of yeast as well.
Yeah, that was something else I was interested to know, actually, is how different was the composition of the bread people were buying in the Victorian time to what people nowadays might buy from the supermarket?
Well, that was the huge challenge for me. I mean, this is what really made the series for me, was that a lot of living history, a lot of reenactment, a lot of sometimes we call it experimental archaeology as well, a lot of that sometimes can be a little bit skin deep. What was great about this program is that these bakers were charged with producing an authentic taste, not just an authentic look, but an authentic taste. And that was really what all of us involved, myself and Annie and the bakers, were really keen to do, was to see if we could actually create something that tasted of Victorian Britain. And I think certainly in the first program, when they were in all of them, but I was really struck in the first program by the taste of that really authentic 1830s bread, using a wheat that was grown at the time, milled to a certain standard, using a yeast which is much more volatile, a sort of historic period brewer's yeast. And, you know, I won't give it away, but for me, the taste was super authentic, and I thought produced something actually very edible.
I mean, we hear a lot nowadays about all the different additives and things that go into mass-produced bread. So, I mean, was the bread that people were eating in this period, would it be more nutritious than what we eat now?
Well, again, you know, we baked through three different periods in Victoria's reign. And what we see is a sort of roller coaster ride, really, through different ingredients. You know, you start off with that very authentic taste. By the time you get into the kind of dark days of Victorian industrialism, you know, you really are scraping the barrel in terms of the kind of stuff they were throwing in their bread. I mean, awful. And the taste of that stuff was just remarkable. I mean, for me, that was the taste of poverty. If you could actually eat that bread, you must have been starving. And then we come out the other end of it where, you know, there is kind of some residual, what we call adulteration, but then you also get more sort of fancy breads, more experimental breads. So, you know, I think viewers are going to love this series because it takes you through that journey. It takes our bakers through that journey as well. And it certainly took my palate, my taste buds through that journey.
And you've mentioned a couple of times now this real low point in the mid-19th century. We tend to think of the 19th century as being a period of great progress, but did you actually see that baking and food standards were going backwards for a time?
Yes. I think it's safe to say, actually, what we see happening in the Victorian period, as you rightfully say, is industrialism. We see what we call progress in inverted commas, technological change, the empire growing. Britain really is at the top of the pile. But as we all know, all historians know, that didn't often spell good news for people lower down the social order. And in fact, things had to get worse before they got better. But what's interesting about baking is that it stayed in the doldrums, actually, for much longer than many other industries. If I was to think of, well, you know, any other industry, but when we think about hygiene standards, for example, and working standards across the board, there had already been commissions on working standards that were trying to improve factory workers' conditions, working hours and wages. It took a lot longer to see those implemented in bakehouses, which was interesting for myself as a historian, but also for our bakers as well. You know, baking sort of stayed in the doldrums a bit.
What impact did the Industrial Revolution have? Because that must have meant you've suddenly got huge urban populations that need a very different kind of baker, possibly, than a small rural community.
Yes, but again, it's an interesting one that, you know, and this is where the story gets interesting, because you can sometimes think of baking in the same way that we think of everything else. Technology brings change and it brings benefit. And that's not often the case. What we see is city centres exploding in terms of their population. But with that growth in population, we also see a growth of bakers. You know, undercutting was rife. And when you don't have any measures taken, regulation taken in terms of hygiene, in terms of working hours, in terms of quality, anyone could set up as a baker. So you see a sort of flooding of the marketplace. So whereas you would expect technology to drive up standards and to meet with the demands of this growing population, it doesn't, because when everyone's setting up a bakery on a street corner, there's a lack of capital investment. Lack of capital investment means you don't buy in the technology, the mixing machines, and all of the various different scientific approaches that were being adopted then. What you actually find is baking stays in that kind of 1830s, 1840s world. Very, very basic, hands-on baking.
What were kind of the economics like of baking? Do we know how much bread have cost in those days? Would it have been a much higher proportion of someone's income than it is, say, nowadays?
Much higher proportion, and it's difficult across the whole period. It's very difficult to give you very exact statistics. But food in general, all types of food, was taking up very much more people's weekly and monthly earnings. The cost of living was relatively high compared to how it is today, and you know, that was very much the case with baking and daily bread. There were very, very fine margins for bakers. Their chief expense would have been flour, and behind that, labour. So, you know, if you could get in an unskilled labourer cheaper than a seasoned baker, you would try and do so. If you could put all sorts of nasties in your bread instead of flour, you would do so, just to try and eke out profits. Because you've got to remember, bakers themselves had, you know, they had costs, they had rents to pay, and they had bellies to feed as well in their own houses. So, you know, certainly in the mid-Victorian period, it was a gritty industry. It really was quite cutthroat. We come out of that through the 1880s to the sort of turn of the century, and we actually see some improvements. Baking is sort of more recognisably 20th century, and bakers do have opportunities to specialise. They have opportunities to create finer pastries, to bring in confectionery. You know, they've got two ways. They can either go mass market, which is of course what we see in baking, or they can go niche speciality. And we decided to go down the niche speciality. It worked very well. Dunn's Bakery in Crouch End, wonderful bakery there that's been there for over 100 years. We managed to commandeer a section of their bakery to attempt some of those kind of turn of the century, late Victorian, Edwardian types of confectionery, pastry, cakes and bread.
This more discerning bakers, does that really reflect the kind of changes going on in wider society of how people may have had more disposable income, may have been a growing middle class to buy these products?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so they've got more disposable income, but we've also got to remember in the late Victorian period, there's a lot more food available to people. You know, the same steam shipping that's bringing in cheaper grain from the United States and Canada is also bringing in cattle, beef from Argentina, bringing in lamb from places like New Zealand. You've got Danish bacon, you've got cheeses from the Low Countries, you've got developments in potato growing technology means that you don't have the same problems with blight, so there's many potatoes on the British diet. Fish as well, steam trawling, a lot more fish. So in some ways, bread actually slipped down the pecking order in terms of being the staff of life. And that was another reason why bakers had to do something extra with their bread. They had to kind of, turn it into something enjoyable, because it had kind of become stigmatized. Bread was the food of the masses. If you were on the way up, sort of middling sort, and you wanted to look impressive, you didn't want to be seen eating bread, because that was the food for poor people.
Talking about the history of baking more generally, I mean, how much has something like the Great British Bake Off done to make people more interested in how people used to bake in centuries past?
Do you know what I think this baking craze, I think a lot of it is about our need to do stuff with our hands. We are makers, we are creators, and we have, as a generation, we are spending far too much time sat in front of pixelated screens, pixelated versions of reality, and we don't do anything, we don't make anything. So we love gardening, allotments, but there's one thing we can do, which is incredibly creative. It involves working with raw materials to create something that can be enjoyed by all, and that's cooking, and baking obviously is a big part of that. And I think that's what that baking is tapping into. And then once you get this culture of baking, very naturally, you're going to get people who want to really get, a bit like me, they want to get to the bottom of something. How exactly did something used to be cooked? Why do we call it this? Why was it made like this? Those are the sorts of questions you start asking, and you want to dive deeper and deeper into the history of creating something. And in some ways, it's the kind of history I love. I call it hands-on history. And our bakers were absolutely superb at this. I mean, just hats off to them. Absolute pleasure to work with them. We got bakers here from different backgrounds that brought a different level of expertise in, or different types of expertise, I should say. We've got super commercial bakers right down to artisan bakers and everything in between there. They gelled as a team superbly. They all brought something to the party. And I've watched some of the footage, and they are a very warm, engaging, and intelligent, very well-informed bunch. And the programme, I think, will be a success because of what they brought to it.
That was Alex Langlands. Victorian Bakers is due to begin on Tuesday, the 5th of January, on BBC Two. Please check a listing service for the exact time. And it will also be available on the BBC iPlayer. Now, for the past year and a half, we've been running a series in the magazine and on the podcast called Our First World War that charts the events of that conflict 100 years on, through the voices of those who lived and fought through it. Well, we've now arrived at December 1915, and here, speaking to the Imperial War Museum, is Private Harold Hayward, recalling an unpleasant experience that took place during a wiring expedition in No Man's Land.
I remember the first time we went over wiring, of course everything was going out over the top tonight, and go quietly, not a word to one another. And we hadn't got, it was rough, outside barbed wire here, no barbed wire there, and we were going to make a thing, a proper continuous line. Well, I was just along, I just happened to step to one side, and I went up there into a French latrine. I thought, I thought to myself, well, people, I said, help, help. They say, shh, shh. I thought, I'm not going to die like this, that when my parents asked me what caused his death, that he fell into a latrine and was drowned. And so they pushed their rifles down, and I caught hold of two of them, and they pulled me out. But no one would come near me for the rest of the time in the line.
That was Harold Hayward. Our First World War continues each month in BBC History magazine. And that is pretty much it for this week, and indeed this year. But please do listen in next time, when we'll be broadcasting a lecture from our 2015 History Weekend event. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast. which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.